Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. With just under 2 weeks to go before Election Day, New Hampshire's electoral arena is jam-packed with political action. As gubernatorial candidates Chris Sununu and Molly Kelly prepare for tonight's forum at Manchester Community College, to be broadcast live on NHPR at 7 p.m., a host of other electoral contests are turning into the home stretch. In addition to governor, voters will cast ballots for Congress, the state legislature, and the governor's executive council. On today's show, we'll look at the big players and key issues driving the final days of the campaign, and we'll assess the political mood of the Granite State from highly polarized partisans to famously unpredictable independents. We'll also consider what a change in the balance of power in the state legislature might mean for the future of New Hampshire's Secretary of State, Bill Gardner. Today on The Exchange, it's a midterm election preview, and we'd like to hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And joining me in studio for the show this morning, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization focused on civic engagement, formerly known as the Live Free or Die Alliance. And Anna, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Chris Galdieri, Associate Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College. And Chris, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too, Dean.
And Paul Steinhauser, veteran New Hampshire political journalist. And Paul, thanks for coming in this morning.
Always good to join you guys.
Before we move on to talk about the governor's race, let's start by talking about New Hampshire voters for a moment. We're only 13 days out from Election Day. You're all paying close attention. And I want to get a sense of how you view the mood of the electorate. And Chris Galdieri, let me turn to you first.
Okay, I think the mood of the electorate, the big story is what we've seen dominating politics since Donald Trump's inauguration, which is Democratic enthusiasm, Democratic anger over the state of the country. And I think that's one of the things that makes 2018 likely nationwide to be a pretty good year for Democrats. I think the big question first is how good a year is that going to be? And second, are Republicans playing catch up? I think there have been some indications since the Kavanaugh nomination and then with Trump hitting the campaign trail that perhaps Republicans' enthusiasm is rising to approach that of the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. And Anna, I think there was the recent WMUR poll suggested that perhaps the Democratic enthusiasm was a little bit higher, that that Republican bump from Kavanaugh had maybe faded a little bit in the state. But nonetheless, what are your expectations?
Sure. So yeah, if we were looking back at the primary, it definitely looked like Democrats were more fired up. But now it is a lot more even. And it was actually the UNH Granite State poll that showed that the Kavanaugh hearing had really fired up Republicans. But the other thing that's interesting is that, and this poll showed this, but also I've been getting this sense from people I talk to, a lot of independents are kind of getting a little fed up, maybe. They're seeing this partisanship and they're feeling left out. They're feeling, I don't want to touch it. So that was the interesting thing I noticed most recently in that poll, is that some independents are saying they're less likely to vote now.
And we know the independents is the largest block of voters in the state. It's upwards of 40, 42%, something like that. So that could, if they stay home, that could have a big impact.
It could have a huge impact.
Yeah. Paul, your sense?
Not just the UNH poll, the St. A's poll as well that came out a couple of days earlier indicated the same thing. 90% of Democrats said they were likely to vote, very likely to vote. But guess what? Same amount for Republicans. So that gap we saw almost all year, and it was definitely highlighted in the primary, seems to be disappearing, whether it's Kavanaugh or other examples, or maybe just Republicans waking up and realizing that the midterms are just 2 weeks away. It seems like the enthusiasm gap has definitely narrowed.
So we are talking about a midterm here, though, and we know historically turnout in midterms can be somewhere in the 30s, mid-30s. Some I've seen as low as, I think, 2014. It was something like 33%. So, Paul, what are your expectations, though, for overall turnout in the Granite State?
Much higher this time around. And the predictions are going to be that this may be one of the highest turnouts since 2010 or maybe 2006, which were both years we know that the Democrats and then the Republicans did extremely well, wave years.
And for either Chris or Anna, mm-hmm. what do you think is driving that? Is this really about Trump, or is this something specific to New Hampshire, do you think?
I think that it is a reflection of the trend you're seeing nationally. I think, you know, just as you saw, you know, a women's march in D.C. the day after the inauguration, there were a lot of marches and protests and that sort of thing here. And so I think that's that same national phenomenon is what's happening here in New Hampshire.
So these midterm elections actually, Anna, seem to be a little bit nationalized in some respects. Mm-hmm. I'm a believer that that we're all so ensconced in social media now that everybody just is kind of getting cranked up by what they're reading on a daily basis on their Twitter feed or their Facebook page.
Absolutely. I think we can't, you know, discount the role that social media has had. It was obviously clear in the last elections. And of course, there's now lots of allegations that social media was misused and there was Russian interference. But that's going to affect us just as much in the midterms, because as you said, it's also what you see your friends posting, what other political parties are paying for ads. You know, digital ad spending is definitely something I'm noticing this year a lot in campaign finance reports. So I would say, but I will also say that the other thing is there are a couple New Hampshire specific issues that I think people are getting really fired up about. Mm-hmm. Family medical leave. I know we're going to touch on some of these later, but so I would say it's not just Trump. I do think that there are some state factors.
Yeah. Chris. Yeah. And speaking of social media, I think it's made it possible for everyone with even a passing interest in politics to treat every single, you know, state legislative special election in Wisconsin or a special election for the House in mm-hmm. Pennsylvania or Ohio becomes a national event.
Yeah. Social media is the great nationalized. I think for
exactly,
voters,
and exactly.
it seems like it's getting everybody wound up, and you know, maybe that'll have a positive effect on turnout. Mm-hmm. But I think it also adds to kind of the intensity and anxiety that a lot of people have about voting. Okay, let's turn to the governor's race specifically. And Paul, let me turn to you first. I'm interested in each of you hearing kind of a 30-second or minute snapshot on where you think that governor's race is right now.
Well, let's start with the polls. Both the two polls we've been talking about, the UNH and the St. Anselm, they indicate that Chris Sununu is winning by either 10 or 11 points with 2 weeks to go. That's a healthy margin right there. It's outside the sampling error for either poll. I thought the other striking numbers from the polls were Molly Kelly is running for statewide office with 2 weeks to go. 42% of those who were questioned in the St. A's poll did not know enough about her to form an opinion, and 48% in the UNH poll. That's kind of high with just... at this point in the campaign. The other thing that struck me was I covered the first debate the other day, which was down in Nashua with the Chamber of Commerce. You name the issue, they disagree. Taxes, minimum wage, workforce development, family leave, commuter rail, voter laws, energy bills, gun safety laws, marijuana legislation, and public financing of elections. That was the only thing that they agreed on. Other than that, these two people are widely apart when it comes to the issues.
Mm-hmm. Anna.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing that, you know, you talked about name recognition, and that's huge. We saw that was a real struggle for Colin Van Ostern in 2016, and it is a little surprising considering that she did serve in state office before. But the other thing that I will say is Sununu also has the benefit of much larger fundraising numbers. So there was a lot of news that said, okay, since the primary, she's raised more than him, and that's absolutely true. But he's still got about $500,000 on her. He also outspent her by about $100,000 in this last reporting period. So I think that she definitely has an uphill battle. But once again, we've talked about those independents are a wild card. And if there is that Democratic wave that we have been talking about for the past few months, it could boost her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris.
Yeah, I generally agree. Sununu is a very popular governor. He's leading in polls. He's not necessarily leading by as much as you'd expect, given polls that had his approval up around, you know, in the mid-60s. He mm-hmm. tends to be pulling around 50%. But for Kelly, the issue is just there's 2 weeks to go. And large chunks of the electorate just don't know who she is or don't know much about her. And unless she can improve those, it's really tough to see. You'd need a very, very, very big blue wave.
I'm sorry, continue.
To help her out with that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit now specifically about issues and start with Chris Sununu and I'll turn to you, Paul Steinhauser. What is Chris Sununu's argument or his case for reelection in terms of policy specifically?
Well, he basically touts his achievements this past 2 years in the corner office. He talks about how he's repaired the mental health system in this state. He talks about being the first governor to provide full day kindergarten statewide. So, and he's got some achievements that actually cross over and that have bipartisan appeal. And he talks about them nonstop on the campaign trail. He also is critical of Molly Kelly when it comes to taxes, when it comes to family leave, the family leave bill that she's been supporting and talking about nonstop the last couple of weeks. And I will say one other thing besides the issues is we've been talking about this race. He's got history on his side, right? Only one governor in the last 90 years has lost reelection to a second 2-year term. You really got to do a really bad job to not get reelected.
Yeah, and Paul, you mentioned the Sununu's attack on Molly Kelly, talking about taxes and spending. Let's listen to a little bit of what he said to you recently.
Molly Kelly has increased taxes over 50 times in this state. When she was a state senator, she left almost a $1 billion deficit. That's a record, a failure. That's a model that just didn't work for New Hampshire.
And that is Governor Chris Sununu talking with Paul Steinhauser attacking Molly Kelly. And I've seen a couple of Sununu commercials on television, and some tagline like "New Hampshire is back," a general message of economic prosperity.
Yes. And so Molly Kelly actually is bouncing off that. And her sort of tagline is an economy that works for everyone. So she's not denying that certain numbers are up in New Hampshire, but she says that it's the top of the tier that's benefiting. And so that's why she's also said she wants to end the business profits tax cuts. She says that could raise another $100 million. She's interested in paid and family medical leave. She's interested in increasing the minimum wage. So she sees the same numbers that Sununu sees, but she's playing the opposite side of it. She said this isn't benefiting everyone.
And let's listen to Molly Kelly talking about this issue with Paul Steinhauser.
You know, just about everything that I find that the Republicans disagree with or don't support, they say that it is an income tax. And that's a political scare tactic is what I think it is. The people and the voters here in New Hampshire are smarter than that. They know I do not support and would veto an income tax, and they value this policy and want to move forward with it.
That is gubernatorial candidate Molly Kelly talking with Paul Steinhauser. And Chris, let me ask you, you've been studying politics here in the state for many years. We're talking a reversion of the pledge there about whether or not we're going to raise income taxes. This is still a pretty potent issue for New Hampshireites, correct?
It is. I mean, even if you're not someone who moves to the state because there's no state income tax, I think a lot of people move to the state and discover, oh, that's kind of nice. I like that every April 15th. And I don't know that it has the same sort of, you know, totemic power that it did, you know, 40 or 50 years ago. But I think for Democrats, you have to make clear that you're not trying to impose an income tax, not trying to impose a broad-based sales tax if you're going to have a chance of winning statewide office.
And that happened. That was very clear at the Nashua debate earlier this week, the first showdown between the two candidates. You know, as you heard on that sound clip there from Sununu, he brought it up a couple times in the showdown that, you know, she's all about raising taxes. And she had to say about three or four times, mm-hmm. She had to be very clear, I will not put in an income tax or a sales tax. So she has to play a little defense on the issue of taxes. That's not helpful.
Hey, Chris, just thinking about what you just said, it's true. People I've known who have moved here and spent 5, 10, 15 years, they all start to adopt the, we have no income tax, mm-hmm. We have no sales tax. So I think you're right. I think it is potent. And let me ask you another question as somebody who studies campaigns. My sense from kind of watching the discourse out there on this governor's race, and in particular Molly Kelly's advertising, a couple of very powerful commercials about people who need family medical leave, and playing on the idea that Chris Sununu used the word vacation when talking about this policy. Is there any danger here of Molly Kelly becoming a single issue candidate on this? Or do you think that because in some way Democrats like this issue, that's why she needs to capitalize on it?
Yeah, I would tend to fall down on the latter side of that. I think this is a good issue for Democrats. That's why Democrats talk about it so much. I think the vacation remark that the governor made is potentially, you know, very potent. I think the issue for Kelly is, does she have the time to capitalize on that? I think this is a place where the late primary really hurts her. And then does she have the money to get that message out? And I think that's tough on both fronts.
I will say, though, why, you know, if she already has Democrats in her pocket, they're not going to vote for Sununu. We know that. So why is she emphasizing this issue unless they really think it's something that will work with independents, this 40% of the voters who are undeclared? Also, you're seeing Kelly's campaign now pivot from family leave, which we've spent the last 3 weeks on, to school choice, the school choice bill known as the school voucher bill by opponents. She was out with a new ad this morning, a new TV ad this morning on that, and she was going to have a couple of campaign events on that. So she is shifting now with these final 2 weeks to another issue.
And Anna, let me ask you, and that was my concern, because if you had asked me a week or so about Molly Kelly, all I really knew about her was his family medical leave act position. But it sounds like maybe they're shifting. Maybe it's in time. Maybe it's too late. I don't know. But I'm interested in your thoughts.
Yeah. So I've definitely heard that come up recently, too. And her argument is these education savings accounts, which have been called a voucher program. It's a little more complex than that. But she says it'll raise property taxes. So I think she's trying to flip that narrative on taxes and saying, OK, this is actually going to hurt people. I will just wanted to throw out there the one issue I'm surprised isn't coming up more is marijuana legalization, because Sununu has said, no, I'm against it. I've already decriminalized. I've been the most progressive governor on this issue. It's not happening. Molly Kelly has said the opposite. She said, yeah, let's regulate, let's tax. We have that report coming out next week on how New Hampshire could structure this. And just something that I've seen and you know, on social media and members of our website, people do get fired up about this issue, including libertarians. So I'm a little surprised that neither candidate is really pushing that as a way to maybe get some more of those independent voters.
Yeah, what do you think about that, Chris?
Yeah, and it seems like an issue that should play into the whole live free or die ethos of the state. And I think, generally speaking, marijuana legislation has fairly broad support. So.
Particularly now that we're surrounded by multiple states
and
Canada.
Right. Yeah. So even if you're not a fan, I think the policy argument is so people are just going to go to other states to do that instead of they could be doing that here and we could be collecting taxes on it.
And it came up Monday in that first showdown. And yes, you know, she had her case that let's do it. Let's legalize it and tax it. He said this is not the time to do it, not in the middle of a drug crisis. It's the line he's used over and over as well. But it's a good point that neither has really campaigned on it outside of these debates.
And Anna, let me ask you about the Trump factor. I mean, the assumption going into this was that the Democrats would just plaster Chris Sununu with Donald Trump. And, you know, Trump's popularity has come up a little bit. He's up in the mid-40s now, but he's kind of where Obama and Clinton were when they took big hits in their first midterm election. So we don't know what's going to happen nationally. But have the Democrats tried in the gubernatorial race to plaster Sununu with the Trump label or no?
I haven't seen a lot of that, no. And I think that that's partly because Trump at this point, from what I've seen, people kind of don't want to talk about it either way. It's definitely still coming up in the congressional race, but I think that people kind of are saying, all right, let's just focus on New Hampshire. This is where most of the policy is happening, and that's sort of noise. You know, let's focus on the real issues.
Yeah. And Paul, your thoughts?
Yeah, outside of social media. Like, if you go on Twitter or Facebook, you're going to see it. And the Democrats, the state Democratic Party, has been attacking Sununu for over a year now, tying him to Trump. But no, you're not seeing it in the television commercials. You're not seeing it when the candidates are on the stump. They don't really talk about Donald Trump, neither of them. The only time they talk about it is when they're asked by us reporters about Trump.
Yeah. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think the only exception is during the Kavanaugh nomination fight. I think there was a bit of a criticism from the Kelly campaign toward the governor about that. But other than that, I don't really think this has been an election or a campaign about Trump.
And I've noticed that particularly from Molly Kelly, there's been quite a list of political A-listers. Kirsten Gillibrand was in the state campaigning. She's had, I think, fundraising letters from Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker from New Jersey, Kamala Harris from California. Is that going to make a difference, you think? You think that's feeding into her fundraising success?
Unfortunately, I think that a lot of those candidates who, for example, Kirsten Gillibrand, are early presidential hopefuls possibly, I think that they also struggle with name recognition in New Hampshire. So I think that that might help her build that Democratic base, since she still does need name recognition among Democrats, too. But I'm not convinced that it's going to sway other voters.
Yeah. And Chris, I often find when these big names come in, everybody, all the media coverage is on the presidential bid, not on the actual gubernatorial candidate.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think what would be more helpful for Kelly would be if these candidates came and brought lots of money with them. But what we haven't seen is a big investment from, you know, the Democratic Governors Association or from Democratic-leaning super PACs.
Paul,
that's a great point. Jay Inslee, the chair, the Washington State governor and the chair of the DGA, came here the day after the primary. He stood with Molly Kelly in an event. Have we seen any big infusion yet from the DGA?
No. Well, we do need to take a quick break, but coming up, more on the race for governor and the executive council, along with some other key election issues. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis in for Laura Kanoy. Today, the race for governor, the executive council, and some other election items of interest. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. I have three guests with me in studio today. Paul Steinhauser, New Hampshire political journalist. Chris Galdieri, associate professor of political science at St. Anselm College. And Anna Brown, director of research and analysis at Citizens Count, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization promoting civic engagement. And before the break, we were talking about the governor's race. Before we move on to the executive council, we should mention that there is a Libertarian candidate in the race this time, Jaletta Jarvis. And let me turn to you first, Anna, to talk a little bit about how the Libertarians factor into this.
Sure. So Libertarians did get full party status this year. They're on the ballot in their own category. And Jaletta Jarvis is in many ways sort of, well, she is. She's the third alternative to Sununu and Kelly. And so, for example, she's in favor of marijuana legalization. She doesn't want any more taxes coming into the state. She kind of wants that handoff approach from the government. So I think that the interesting factor will be to see if she sort of pulls any votes away from Sununu. And in the polling, you know, obviously she's not pulling as high, nearly as high as either of them. But I do think it's possible, especially in those undecided voters, if they're dissatisfied with both parties, as we've seen these independents sort of backing off, whereas the partisanship is getting more and more, you know, maybe she could pull down some of that Republican vote.
Mm-hmm. And Paul, the Libertarians had their own ballot for the first time. I think in the primary, there are about 1,000 ballots that were cast out of several hundred thousand votes. You're out on the campaign trail every day. Is the Libertarian ethos or the candidacy of Jaletta Jarvis, is that filtering into the discourse or not so much?
A little bit. I'll be honest. You know, the Democratic and Republican nominees are dominating this race as they have in the past. But again, yeah, she could definitely be a factor in swaying the election one way or another if it's very close. Remember Max Abramson? He was the nominee last time around in 2016. He won just over 4% of the vote. That's something to talk about.
Yeah, Chris, in a close race could make the difference.
Yeah, I think a lot of people look at the Senate race in 2016 and say in that race the Libertarian candidate made the difference between Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan. If you know Molly Kelly catches fire, or if Democrats really come home to her in the final stretch of the campaign, who knows? Libertarians could be a factor in this race as well.
So perhaps the role of spoiler, although that's not necessarily the role that they want to play. I'm sure they prefer to be, you know, a competitive alternative. Okay, so let's shift gears now. We talk about the governor. The other part of the gubernatorial equation is the governor's executive council. It's a little bit of an unusual institutional structure here in New Hampshire. And Chris Galdieri, let me turn to you first. What is the executive council and why do we have it, just in case listeners are not that familiar with it?
Sure. New Hampshire's executive council is a holdover from the colonial era. Initially, it was, I believe, part of the legislature. Then during the American Revolution, New Hampshire wrote its own state constitution and decided to make the executive council a check on the governor. And it's basically continued in that form ever since. So the executive council has to work with the governor on issues like spending, issues on certain appointments. They do executive branch oversight. And it's really unusual. There are very few states that still have anything like this. It's also part of why so many New Hampshire governors want to become senators, because if you become a senator, you don't have like a five-person board of directors you have to answer to on a regular basis.
Yeah, and Anna, we've seen, my sense is in recent years, this has become a little bit of a launching pad for, as arcane as it is, a little bit of a political launching pad. Colin Van Ostern, Chris Pappas, others.
Our governor.
Governor. Absolutely, Chris Sununu. And Andrew Walensky, another executive counselor who's occasionally mentioned as a future gubernatorial candidate. But your sense of the council and its role?
Yeah, well, I think that the executive council is something that most people in New Hampshire probably don't pay any attention to until there's a big issue. And so I'd say that the Planned Parenthood contract comes up. Whenever that comes up, people say, oh, yeah, the executive council has a big role. And of course, Governor Sununu, when he was a counselor, was considered a swing vote on that. Also, the council is responsible for approving appointments.
Court appointments.
Cabinet and court appointments.
Yeah.
Yep. So Frank Edelblue, when he was confirmed as Commissioner of Education, people thought he was perhaps coming in with an agenda. They didn't like him. So that was controversial. And also judges. And I thought it was a little interesting because when that recent ruling came down on SB3, which was the voter registration bill, Sununu said that was politically motivated And that was a judge that was appointed under Governor Lynch. So these things do come back around. Right. Definitely don't underestimate the executive council.
Yeah, I think it's become an increasingly important part of the political landscape.
It has definitely become more political in recent years. You talked about the former counselors who are now in higher office or have seeked higher office. Also, for somebody who covers the council meetings, I remember in particular the Planned Parenthood funding, the state funding for Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. That was a huge political hot item, and there was a lot of protest around that back in 2015 and 2016 in those votes, and it was right front and center in the governor's race as well. You know, right now, the council is controlled 3-2 by Republicans, and we're keeping our eyes on a number of close races, especially the one for the District 4, which includes Manchester, but not just Manchester, a lot of towns. This is Chris Pappas's seat, but he obviously is not running for re-election as he's going for Congress. This is one where Ted Gatzis, the former mayor of Manchester, former state Senate president, this is a seat that could flip from Democratic control to Republican control. The Democrat running in that race is also pretty well-known, Gray Chenoweth, a high-tech executive.
Also a Libertarian candidate, Richard Tommaso. Paul, I don't know if you've been covering this particular race directly, but NHPR's Sarah Gibson reported that Ted Gatzis skipped the Chamber of Commerce debate and declined a Norwood debate. Have you heard anything out there in the stump about whether he's engaging?
Democrats have been critical of him, obviously, for that, and they've been pointing it out and trying to highlight that. Ted Gatzis campaigns his own way, the Democrats will batter him on that, but let's be honest. He's got a lot of name recognition. He has lost his last two elections. He made the bid, obviously, for the gubernatorial nomination on the Republican side in 2016, and then he lost his re-election bid in 2017 for Manchester mayor. But he's still very well known in that area. And remember, it's not just Manchester. That district goes way out on the Route 4 corridor all the way to Barrington and Northwoods, some pretty conservative areas.
We're doing a midterm election preview here on The Exchange. You can call in and join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm in studio with Anna Brown of Citizens Count, Chris Galdieri of St. Anselm College, and veteran New Hampshire political journalist Paul Steinhauser. And Anna, let me turn to you for your thoughts on this District 4 race and your sense of that race.
Sure. Well, it was a really exciting race also in the primary because Gray Chenoweth was challenged by Garth Corvo. And so the one thing that I've noticed is Ted Gatzis, of course, has that huge name recognition that he's working with, but he has not been fundraising as much as Chenoweth. On the other hand, Chenoweth had to spend a lot of that money in the primary. So now they're looking about even in terms of what they have left in their war chests. So the other thing that I will say is interesting is, so Pappas won about 5% by about 5% in 2016. So I think that's definitely enough of a margin that, you know, it could flip either way. I would say, once again, having the Libertarians in here, we don't want to talk about them just as spoilers because they do have their own issue positions that they're bringing to the table, that they can change the debate. But I do wonder if that could take away from Gatzis.
Mm-hmm. And Paul Steinhauser, let me turn to you on District 5. Former executive counselor Deb Pignatelli is getting back to challenge Dave Wheeler, Republican. Also a Libertarian candidate, Brian Chabot. What's your sense of District 5?
This is one Democrats hope to flip. They're keeping their eyes on this. They tried to get Wheeler out 2 years ago. They weren't successful, but Pignatelli is very well known down there. Listen, you know, she was a state senator. She spent about a decade in the council, and she is a pretty active campaigner. Wheeler kind of campaigns his own way. I'll be generous. It's a quiet way of campaigning. I think this is going to be a close one. This district obviously favors, other than Nashua, it favors Republicans. When the redistricting happened at the beginning of the decade, they shifted it a little bit to favor the Republicans. Democrats, this may be their one good shot at a pickup.
Yeah. Anna, your thoughts on District 5?
Yeah, I think that it's, once again, these are both well-known names in that region of the state. They both have held office before. They've both been going back and forth. I think it's interesting because, as you said, Wheeler really is a quiet campaigner. You know, I've brought up a couple different numbers of fundraising. He's not that big on fundraising, you know? He just does it. He does it his own way. But he did win by about 9% in 2016. That is a pretty large margin. So I think that, once again, this might be an issue of voter turnout. You know, is it the Democrats that are showing up or is it the Republicans?
And Chris, let me turn to you with a slightly more general question. That we had an email from a Christopher who asks about the likability factor. And he was talking in terms of the government, the governor's race, that we're talking a lot about policy, but really people are just kind of making decisions based on likability. For something like the executive council, where the people are not particularly well known, but how do you see that weighing into the decision to vote?
I mean, you know, to be glib about it, I think it's better for voters to find you likable than not. I think if voters respond to you, if they find you, you know, warm and empathetic, or they think you are a competent leader, that's only going to help you at the polls.
Yeah. So, I mean, policy, people maybe focus on that a little bit less than you might think.
I think so. I mean, with an office like the Executive Council, I think a lot of voters who aren't that familiar with it or who don't pay attention when the Planned Parenthood funding comes up, they go in, they might be planning to vote for governor or for their congressional
election. And
they see this thing. Yeah,
exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I will say, and it's not the case this year, it's the case every year. The top of the ballot ticket, the top of the ballot races impact the bottom of the ballot races, the down ballot races. So what happens in the governor's race and in the congressional races will definitely impact voters when it comes to the executive council, when it comes to their state senator and their state rep, because they don't know a lot of people don't know the names when they start going down the ballot.
Yeah. And Paul, let me ask you about you had mentioned one or two other races that you were interested in following. And Anna, you follow this closely as well. But Paul, you first. What other races are you watching besides 4 and 5?
Well, I live in the Seacoast, right, in Rockingham County, Newfield. So I'm keeping my eye on District 3, which covers pretty much all of Rockingham County. And you have an incumbent, Russell Prescott, Republican, who succeeded Sununu on the council. Russell Prescott's a former state senator who is now, as I said, in his first term. He had a little problem, though. He backed those toll increases, and that upset a lot of conservatives. In fact, there was almost a primary challenge against him. So that's not helping him. The Democrat in the race, Joe Pace, has been nonstop, relentless on the campaign trail. So keep your eyes on that one. The flip side of that, though, is that district is very heavily leaning Republican. You get outside of Portsmouth, you get outside of Exeter, that's our country.
And Anna, anything else you're watching in addition to 4 and 5?
Sure. I'm actually watching District 1. We have another rematch between Michael Cryans and Joe Kenney. Joe Kenney won in 2016 by about 5%. I would say, considering that there was a large Republican turnout that year, that's not too huge of a margin that it couldn't flip. We have another Libertarian up there, Tobin Menard. So I definitely think that that could be a surprise flip. I think that district might change.
Yeah. I will say to our listeners, if you haven't paid a lot of attention to the executive council, it's some really interesting politics. I mean, I think it's increasingly become a launch pad for higher office. And there's just some really interesting politics going on in those districts.
And I will say the one we didn't talk about, let's just get it out.
Cover
there.
Them all. Yeah.
Yep. District 2, which right here in Concord. But this district is a Democratic leaning district that goes from Keene almost all the way to the ocean, to Dover. And you've got Andrew Valinsky, the first term Democrat, who succeeded Colin Van Ostern on the council. He's obviously running for re-election. Republican Jim Beard, an aircraft manufacturing salesman and executive.
And Anna, as you I think you mentioned it when you mentioned Frank Edelblut, Andrew Valinsky got a lot of media coverage for his. Really, it was like almost like a prosecutorial examination of Edelblut.
Yes, absolutely. And so the other thing that I wanted to throw out, that we've talked about how, you know, they cover appointments, they cover contracts, they might run for office in the future. I would say don't just choose the party when you're voting for this person. You know, you talked about how Russell Prescott was open to those toll increases. You know, you can't just trust that you're going to agree with someone just because they're a D or an R, or for that matter, an L. And so I will say that's, you know, really the mission of Citizens Count. Go to our website, citizenscount.org. We do have issue positions and profiles for all of these candidates.
Well, Chris, isn't it, I mean, more generally the case that increasingly, certainly at the presidential level, but maybe even a little below that, people tend to vote for the individual, not just the party. We don't have straight ticket voting in New Hampshire anymore.
We don't have straight ticket voting. But I think, you know, 2018 could be a year where people are only voting
by
party.
You think that the polarization is so intense?
I don't want to, you know, step on Citizen Count's toes, but I think 2018 has been such a polarized year. I think a lot of folks are going to go in, and if you are mad as heck about the direction of the country, you're going to vote for D's all the way from governor to dog catcher. And if you think things are going great, you're going to do the same thing, vote R's for all the way down the ticket. I think that's just going to be one of the things that will be really interesting to see how
that is very interesting. It's a little different than the presidential race, where people increasingly focus on the individual. Yeah, Paul.
I will say, you know, New Hampshire has a very good history, a rich history of very informed electorate and voters who crisscross on the ballot, who will vote here for a Democrat, but there for a Republican. But the national climate is really making an impact on New Hampshire. And in some ways, Concord is becoming more and more like Washington, D.C. And maybe that's not a good thing, is it?
Let's shift gears now and talk about a very interesting race that's flying a little bit under the radar. But for people who follow politics closely, it's a pretty interesting one. We know that the entire state legislature here in New Hampshire, 400 in the House and 24 in the Senate, is up for re-election every 2 years. But a byproduct of the results are our Secretary of State. The legislature is going to get together in December and choose the Secretary of State. So it's not traditionally an electoral office in the traditional sense, but we're going to have a vote. Bill Gardner, I think, is going for a 22nd term in office. He was first elected in 1976. Things are a little bit different now. Anna, say a little bit about what's going on with the Secretary of State's challenge.
So Bill Gardner, as you said, he's been our Secretary of State for
76.
As long as I've been alive. So he is sort of an institution in New Hampshire, and he's particularly known for defending the first in the nation primary. But he sort of stepped on the wrong side of some of our legislators when he started advocating for stricter voter checking laws. You know, so voter registration forms, who can vote, if there's a durational requirement, all those things. So some people argue he shouldn't have done that. You know, that's not the Secretary of State should not be lobbying for certain things one way or another. He argued, I'm protecting the integrity of elections, especially in this time when there's so much news out there about hacking and Russian interference. We need to make sure that if New Hampshire's going to be first in the nation, we have the strongest elections in the country. But what happened is Colin Van Ostern, the former candidate for governor, came forward and said, we don't want the Secretary of State lobbying for these, what he would say is voter suppression laws, basically. And so he has contributed to some of the campaigns of state legislators, and he's hoping to mount a challenge.
Yeah, and this is kind of an indirect sort of thing, Chris, right, where it really depends on, you know, not only Democrats taking the state legislature, but then kind of coalitional politics.
Yeah, and basically the Van Ostern strategy is to try to elect lots of Democrats to the legislature and then hope that those legislators pick him for Secretary of State rather than Bill Gardner. And first of all, it's indirect, so that's always a little bit risky. And I think there's also a concern on the part of some Democrats that it might look like that their support for a Secretary of State candidate is being bargained for or bartered for at the campaign stage. And I think that's created some discomfort.
I'll help you with your campaign if you in turn vote for me. And Paul Steinhauser, we should also mention former Democratic state rep and Manchester alderman Peter Sullivan has thrown his hat in the ring as well.
He has. You know what's fascinating to me about this race is it's a race. It feels like, at least for Van Ostern, it's like an actual campaign. He's out there with fundraising emails. He's having events.
Well, he has an organization, Free and Fair New Hampshire, right, that's been behind this.
So we've never seen this. This is uncharted waters for a race for Secretary of State. Because, again, who gets to vote on this? The 424 state lawmakers. So it's got a different feel to it with Van Ostern in the race, actively fundraising, not for himself, but for these other candidates he hopes to get in there, which he hopes will then support him. It's just bizarre.
Yeah, it's unusual. We certainly haven't experienced anything like this in a while. Anna, your sense of where do you think this is headed?
Honestly, I think that Bill Gardner is an institution in New Hampshire. I think that it would just be so hard to remove him. And I think that he did, you know, really rankle some people this past year. But ultimately, you know, whether he's going to advocate for a policy or not, his day-to-day job protecting that primary, he does it well.
That's what everybody cares about, the primary. So we need to take one more quick break. But coming up, we're going to continue looking at the big players and key issues driving the final days of the campaign. We'll talk a little bit about a couple of ballot amendments that you may be a little bit confused by. I certainly have had to read through them a few times myself. We'll talk about those and take your calls and questions on the 2018 midterm elections. Stay with us. It's The Exchange on NHPR.
In 1985, three boys discovered a blue 55-gallon drum in the woods of Bear Brook State Park.
Keith was trying to pull the top of the barrel off. We got hit with, like, this smell of, like, rotten milk.
Available now from NHPR, Bear Brook, a podcast about a cold case that's changing how murders will be investigated forever. Learn more at bearbrookpodcast.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis, in for Laura Kanoi. Tomorrow, you can hear the rebroadcast of tonight's live forum with gubernatorial candidates Chris Sununu and Molly Kelly. That'll be on tonight at 7 p.m. on NHPR. And you can still get tickets. They're available. They're free. You need to go to nhpr.org/events, and you can find out about that, get more information on tonight's forum. But this hour, we're previewing some of the issues likely to come up in that forum tonight, but also broader election issues involving a variety of the races here in New Hampshire. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And you can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. I have three guests with me in studio. Chris Galdieri is Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Anselm. Paul Steinhauser, New Hampshire political journalist, and Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization promoting civic engagement. I believe they also have an election app out, and you can visit their webpage to get more information on all the candidates. Let's shift gears now and talk a little bit about these ballot questions. There are two questions on the ballot on Election Day dealing with, I believe, amending the state constitution. They're pretty confusing. These ballots give me a lot of intrepidation whenever I approach them and try to figure out how I'm going to vote. One deals with the ability of a taxpayer who's a registered voter to sue local or state governments for misuse of taxpayer funds. And the other deals with privacy and technology. Anna, let me turn to you on
these. Sure. So the first one came about after a lawsuit where it was challenging, I believe it was the tax credit scholarships, where businesses could get a tax credit for donating to a scholarship fund. And some students and other taxpayers tried to sue and said, you are violating the Constitution by spending our taxpayer dollars in this way. And the court, instead of ruling on that constitutionality, said, well, just because we're spending your taxpayer money doesn't mean that that's really a harm you can demonstrate. You don't really have standing to sue us. So basically what this first question says is it says, all right, anybody, any taxpayer has a right to say you're spending my taxpayer dollars unconstitutionally. So it's creating this broader right to sue the government. The judicial branch testified against it because they were concerned that this would really increase the number of lawsuits the state was facing. And they say we don't have enough judges to handle this. They also expressed some concern that it would give the judicial branch too much power, because then basically any taxpayer could say, this law is illegal, it's unconstitutional, challenge it, and then the courts are the ones that are saying whether or not the law flies, any law. So on the other hand, however, it passed almost unanimously.
Yeah, it was
Very popular.
309-73 in the House and 22-2 in the Senate.
Yeah, because, and I think a lot of people look at that case and say, well, yeah, they should have been able to say, you don't get to spend my taxpayer dollars on religious schools or whatever. Whatever the issue is, you have to follow the Constitution when you're spending my dollars. Mm-hmm. So that's the first one.
Yep.
The second one is a right to privacy.
Right.
So the state constitution, as the federal constitution, protects your belongings, your person, from unreasonable searches and seizures, which basically means the government needs to get a warrant if they're going to do a search. When it comes to information and data, it's a little more gray. And the Supreme Court of the United States has had some rulings that say, okay, you got to get a warrant if you want to know someone's, you know, cell phone location, or if you want to put a tracker on their car, or if whatever. But there's this feeling that, what if the government approaches Facebook, and Facebook is a private company? Yeah. You've given them your data voluntarily, so they can do with it what they want. So this right of privacy basically says you have to get a warrant if you want to get this private information. It was Rep. Neil Kirk sponsored this, and he has been a privacy bulldog in the House of Representatives. He's not running for re-election. I think this was his swan song.
No.
He was really happy to get this on the ballot. So once again, though, the judicial system says, okay, this is going to increase the workload. It's going to be really unclear for law enforcement. How might this impact the private sector?
Yeah, and that the definition of privacy is a little vague and challenging. And,
yeah. So I think, honestly, there is just a huge question. What would this ultimate impact be? I think that you would have to see court cases to know exactly what it's protecting, what you need a warrant for, what you don't need a warrant for. And the criticism that I've basically heard is it's not ready for prime time.
Yeah. And Chris, this one passed the House 253-96. and the Senate to 15-9. But it's a challenge, right? You need 2/3 of voters in order for these to be adopted.
That's right. And I think there's enough uncertainty about these. I think a lot of people see something with complex language that they don't necessarily understand. They're in the voting booth. They have to get to work. They have to get home to their families and are probably going to vote no unless it's really crystal clear, unless they really strongly support it.
Okay. So I hope that folks find that helpful. It is a little bit confusing. Paul, do you want to jump in real quick?
Yeah, just because I love being on the exchange, because I just got a text from Colin Van Ostrand to correct something that I said, because I was incorrect. He points out that his political organization, we were talking about how it's been fundraising.
Free and Fair NH.
Exactly. He says he's not raising money specifically for candidates. He's raising money for grassroots and online organizing, for forums on voting rights, civil engagement, and ending gerrymandering. So there we go. A correction.
Yeah, a broader mission. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, and I hope listeners, as I was saying, I hope listeners find that discussion helpful. These ballot questions can be very intimidating, and it's a way to, in theory, change the state constitution. But you do have that very high threshold of 2/3 of voters needed. In the time remaining, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the two House races. We had CD1. Which we know is kind of the sea coast on up into the sort of the eastern half of the state, and then the CD2, which is western and up into the north country. Let's start with CD1. And Chris, you're a Congress guy, so let me turn to you first. We have Republican Eddie Edwards, Democrat Chris Pappas, Libertarian Dan Belforti. This is the open seat from Carol Shea Porter. How is this looking right now?
I'd say this is looking pretty good for Chris Pappas. Between the combination of it looking like a good year for Democrats, Pappas has represented most of that district on the executive council for a number of years. He's well known because his family owns the Puritan. He's raised more money than Edwards. I think he's the favored candidate in that race at this point.
Well, St. A's polling, I think, had him up. I don't know if it was double digits, but it was pretty. And also the UNH poll has him
eight
up.
And nine. Eight and nine. The other.
Eight or nine, right. Yeah. So, Paul, your sense of how you think this race is shaping up?
Yeah, I agree. With 2 weeks to go, Pappas is definitely the favorite. He's got the advantage in the polls. He's got the name recognition slight advantage, and he's obviously got the financial advantage. What's fascinating to me is, remember, this is the first district. It's one of the most high-profile and expensive congressional districts in the country, swing districts. But this year, the national groups are staying out of it. And that probably will hurt Edwards with these final weeks to go. You're not going to see a massive infusion, at least we haven't seen it yet, from some of the super PACs to help Edwards out.
You said they're staying out of it. Why do you think they're staying out of it?
Well, first of all, the Republicans are playing defense mostly overall in this country as they try to keep their majority in the House. So that's where most of the money is going. They've been looking at the polling as well, and maybe they feel like it's not worth an infusion in this race. I don't know if that's the actual case, but maybe.
Yeah. Anna, your sense on CD1?
Sure. Well, I think that honestly, Edwards is struggling with name recognition. I think that, obviously their issue positions are really important. But I think still, if you just ask someone, do you know Chris Pappas? They'll know the name, and it makes a difference. And I will also say that the other thing that I think is interesting about Pappas is he does appeal to some Republicans. He has that business savvy, which I think people appreciate. And also, I think that you've seen that. I remember the Republican Party came out with the criticism saying that, he didn't build his business, he inherited. And then you had Republican Phil Bean coming out and saying, no, don't do that. You can't be critiquing someone's business background. So I think that's his other strength, is he does have a little bit of bipartisan appeal.
Apple.
Either way, regardless of who wins, we're going to have history, obviously, right? Chris Pappas would be the first openly gay member of Congress from New Hampshire. And if Edwards wins, he'll be the first African-American member of Congress from the state of New Hampshire.
Chris, say a little bit more about the first CD. We know it's a swing district. It's kind of, you can track, I think, Carol Shea Porter won in 06 and 08, and then Ginta was in 10, and then Shea Porter came back in 12, and then Frank Ginta was in 14. I think I got it right. Everyone's following the bouncing ball.
Yes. Yeah.
Just want to see if I can pull that off. But why is it such a swing district? And I think Trump won by a few points.
Yeah, it's a swing district because it's a district that there's not a preponderance of the population for one party or the other. So a lot of it just comes down to who's voting, who's surging on election day. Is this a Democratic year? Is it a Republican year? And the first district, it is is very swingy, but it swings with the rest of the country. You know, in years when Democrats are winning seats, the first district tends to go blue. In years where the Republicans are picking up House seats, it tends to go red.
So would your expectation be that candidates would sort of fight for the independents in the middle? Because my sense is that Eddie Edwards has been a very strong supporter of Donald Trump, I think, in a couple issues like bump stocks. Mm-hmm. He's even to the right of Donald Trump. And so is this a really competitive mobilization, or should they be fighting over the independents?
I'd say a little of both.
Okay.
But remember, this is also one of only a dozen districts across the entire country that the Democrats control that Donald Trump won in the 2016 election. He won it narrowly, but he did take the first district. So that's why Republicans have been looking at this district all year long, thinking this may be one of our few blue pickups that we could flip from blue to red. But again, we haven't seen that massive infusion of money either from the NRCC or from outside groups on the Republican side in this race.
And I will say, you know, this is the first midterm for a new president, and you look historically, like Trump has kind of broken some historical rules that we talk about always, you know, the conventional wisdom. And the conventional wisdom is that that first midterm after a new president, that you're going to likely to see some kind of a backlash from the party out of power, and that all things being equal, in a swing district, it's probably better to be a Democrat this time around.
Yes, yes. And that goes back to, once again, people have been talking about for months, that quote-unquote blue wave that's coming, you know. But you're right. It does happen with many presidents. The party power in Congress will flip after those first 2 years. I'm not sure that's why Pappas is necessarily leading in the first district, mm-hmm. though. I do think, once again, that's less about Trump and more about these local candidates, name recognition, people knowing them, what they've done in the state already.
And Chris's ability to turn out, large turnout in Manchester in particular.
Yeah, and we saw that in the primary. That was you know, an 11-person race, and Pappas' strength in Manchester was off the charts. That's one of the things that put him over the top in that primary.
So let's turn in the time we have remaining and talk a little bit about CD2, Democratic Congresswoman Annie Custer, who I think is running for a fourth term. Is that correct? She's been in for three terms, I believe.
And
so fourth term, mm-hmm. Republican challenger Steve Negrin out of Nashua and Libertarian challenger Dustin O'Donnell. Paul Steinhauser is sort of our political radar. This has been the least on the radar, which is usually a good sign for the incumbent.
Yeah, this district leans a little more Democrat than the first. It's still some district where Republicans think they have a chance, but it's going to be tough. Custer is a ferocious fundraiser. She's got almost $2 million still cash on hand. And Negrin, while he's been, you know, actively campaigning and doing a good job out there making his case, he only has about $33,000 in the bank right now. So he doesn't have the money to really compete on air. If you look at the polls, the most recent one was UNH. She's up by 15 points. This is her race to lose, and it doesn't seem like she's going to lose.
And Anna, this seems to be a case of a classic case of sort of a tremendous imbalance in fundraising. Annie Custer has been a pretty prolific fundraiser. And we do know in House races, typically the incumbents, there's a big disparity in cash.
Yes, absolutely. And so I think that Custer has been building her war chest ever since she first took office.
It's over 4 million, years.
It's something like that. Yeah. And so, as you said, just, you know, a few thousand dollars, you know, it's almost insurmountable. It's so hard. But I do think the other thing that's interesting about Custer is she's not sleeping on this campaign. You know, she's not just taking it for granted. And I think that she's taken some strong stands on some things. You know, she discussed a sexual assault that she experienced when she was in college that she survived. And I think that is definitely potentially risky given all the backlash there was during the Kavanaugh hearings from Republicans saying, you know, innocent and proven guilty. Of course, Custer hasn't named anyone. But I think, you know, she's using this campaign to bring forward issues and talk about controversial things. She's, you know, she's not just saying, we'll just phone it in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris?
Yeah, and she had a close call in 2016. Jim Lawrence was the Republican candidate, and he did much better than anybody expected. And I think Custer has responded as a savvy incumbent does in terms of campaigning very aggressively, raising lots of money. I think she's not going to risk being caught like that again.
Yeah, you know, it's striking. I've covered their first two debates. It's striking. And one of them right here at NHPR. Their differences on the issues, especially on climate change, is something she's been definitely bringing up and pointing to Negron's stance on the issue and whether he—
And on abortion as well, if you heard the NHPR debate.
Exactly.
Here, yeah.
Abortion as well. I had a chance to chat with her yesterday. She was campaigning at the Red Arrow Diner on Loudoun Road here in Concord, and she was talking to voters. She was pointing out, you know, and I asked her about Negrin, and she said that he was— too. She's a lovely guy, she said, been a gentleman in this race. It hasn't gotten nasty, but she said he was too extreme, even for his own party. Spoke to him later, and he said no. He pointed to his support for the Republican tax cuts and for beefing up border security, and he said those are not extreme positions.
Yeah, and Anna, this gets to this more general issue of strategy. I've watched a lot of congressional races in the state over the years, and we talk about independence. But this really seems like a case where candidates seem to be embracing the leaders of their parties, kind of acknowledging the polarized nature of this particular year.
Yeah, and I was even sitting here as Paul was talking, and I don't think I can come up with a single issue that the two candidates agree on. And usually there's something. There's something there that everyone says, yeah, this is a good idea.
Oh, I got
this forward. Yeah?
The B1, the HB one or two visas, which allow, you know, workers.
That you're right. More foreign
right.
worker
right.
visas.
Right. They
yes.
both agree on that. That's probably
you're right.
it. That's it.
You're right. Well, I tell you what, that's for New Hampshire, so that's good.
Yeah. So, Chris, polarization's okay this year?
We have a lot of it.
Seems to be driving the candidates.
Yes.
I want to mention before we leave, we going back to our discussion about ballot questions one or two, in case this is helpful for you to know, the ACLU has voiced support for both amendments on the ballot, if that may help you in your decision making process there. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I know we're all going to be listening to that gubernatorial forum tonight, live from Manchester Community College at 7 p.m. on NHPR. As I mentioned, it's going to be rebroadcast tomorrow morning on The Exchange at 9. So you can listen live at 7 p.m. tonight. You can catch it again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. There is still time to register for free tickets to attend the event. So if you're interested in going, it's at Manchester Community College. And you can go to nhpr.org/events and get more information there and register to attend. But I would like to thank my guests for joining us this morning. Anna, thanks so much for coming in.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count. Citizens Count, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization focused on civic engagement, formerly known as the Live Free or Die Alliance. And Chris, good to talk to you.
Always glad to be here.
That is Chris Galdieri, Associate Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College. And Paul, I know and I look forward to reading and watching your dispatches from the campaign trail.
Thanks. Great to be here.
That's Paul Steinhauser, a veteran New Hampshire political journalist. And remember, the conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.